Welcome, everybody. Sorry for the space mix-up. It was beyond our control. Sure. It's beyond our control. We were promised a room, and then we found out it would not be heated, even though we've had talks with them all along. And also, thanks to Kathy and Jane for all their hard work behind the scenes. And frustration and time lost, and without those guys, we couldn't be doing this kind of stuff. So, no, we appreciate your efforts. Today is a continuation of the Digestible Jung series, which is basically spending one day on each of Jung's last major works. We've done Symbols of Transformation, which is not one of his last ones. We did Mysterium. We spent 2 days on Mysterium, Knut Jonas. They were doing Ion. All these were written after 1944, after he had a heart attack. And they really are the summation of his life's work. Just for your information, all the outline of this material and the slides and so on that we're looking about are up on my website if you want to go look at it at your leisure. It's jgsparks.net, and then just click on Digestible, and it'll take you to that page. Here's a quick outline of what we'll be doing today. We'll talk about the word ion, and then we'll talk a little bit about the relevance of the Christ image to this book, and how Jung sees the Christ image playing itself out over the course of Western history. The key symbol that's going to be used in the book is the symbolism of the fish, because that's connected with early Christianity. So we'll be looking at a lot about the symbolism of the fish. We'll be talking about the two fishes. That'll hopefully become clear in a second. The two fishes which symbolize the Christian mentality. The nature of the second fish will occupy us a great deal. How you deal with it, 6 point. And then a model of the self that comes out of this. Let's talk first a little bit about the title, Ion. Ion is the name of a Mithraic god. Mithraism, you probably know, was a religion that reached its apogee in the Roman era. It was the religion of the Roman legions. And one of the gods is Ion. It's the etymological basis of our word eon. So you could call this book pretty much in English eon, but he uses the Latin ion. Ion was a god of the long duration. You know, the Greeks had three words for time. Kronos, Kairos, and Ion. Kronos was the tick, 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 the space between the tick. Kairos was the quality of the moment between the ticks. And Ion was a long period of time, an epoch, you could say. So what this book is, then, is a study of what Jung considers to be the major epochs of Western history, the major eons of Western history, and what that means for us today. As I hope I can show you, Jungian psychology isn't just a method of psychotherapy. It's a method of psychotherapy that Jung developed with an eye to what this historical moment needs. So it's a historically sensitive methodology, and where he got his ideas is from his understanding of history based on the eons that we'll be looking at today. So much for Ion. Or Ion. By the way, it's a seminar, so if you want to stop me, okay, unless there's somebody, I have to say, extroverts, hold back. Otherwise, if what I say is unclear, well, just holler. Okay, now we'll just start going through the book, passage by passage. What I've tried to do is pick out what main sentences there are in the book so that if you spend 4 hours with the main sentences, you'll have some idea what the book's talking about. By the way, we'll go We'll go. We'll probably take a break about 11, and then we'll go to 12. We'll have a lunch break till 1, and then we'll come back. And depending on how much time we need, we'll go stop anywhere between 3 and 4, depending on the discussion and the material. And we'll take a break somewhere in the afternoon as well. Let's just look now at a couple of quotes sequentially, and then I'll stop and try to explain how they all fit together. The first quote I want to look at is on paragraph 74. I'm just going to read you a couple of these quotes, and then we'll try to sum up what's it all about. First sentence on paragraph 74. There can be no doubt that the original Christian conception of the Imago Dei, which means the image of God, embodied in Christ, meant an all-embracing totality that even includes the animal side of man. Now comes the punchline. Nevertheless, the Christ symbol lacks wholeness in the modern psychological sense, since it does not include the dark side of things, but specifically excludes it in the form of a Luciferian opponent. So the first thing that we need to let work on us is the book is going to be about the psychological effect of the Christian understanding of God, or the psychological effect on Western history, and thus on us, of the image of Christ that is embodied in Christianity. That image is split. There's a Christ and there's a devil. So that the Christian psyche is split, if you take that psychologically, between good and evil. We'll follow that up as we go along. Paragraph 76. As I say, I'll go through a couple of these and then I'll try to put them in perspective. First sentence. If we see the traditional figure of Christ as a parallel to the psychic manifestation of the self, then the Antichrist would correspond to the shadow of the self, namely the dark half of the human totality, which ought not to be judged too optimistically. Now the last sentence of that paragraph. In the empirical self, light and shadow form a paradoxical unity. In the Christian concept, on the other hand, the archetype is hopelessly split into two irreconcilable halves, leading ultimately to a metaphysical dualism, the final separation of the kingdom of heaven from the fiery world of the damned.
What was that one?
The last sentence on paragraph 76. Okay. So what he's done now is take what he knows of God images as they appear in the psyche, as they appear in dreams. Self and God image are synonymous. I'm assuming that's familiar to you by now. And noticing that in dreams at depth, these God images appear as a mixture of opposites contained within a whole, not as two separate polarities, good and bad. So he sees that as the deepest image of human nature, and the Christian version of it as a split of that essential, I really can't say unity, but containment of opposites within a whole. So he's just slowly building his argument. We'll get to so what in a second. Now, paragraph 77, which starts becoming relevant to our general thesis. If you go down on paragraph 77, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines. Well, if it starts psychologically, the case is clear. Since the dogmatic figure of Christ is so sublime and spotless that everything else turns dark besides it. Psychologically, the case is clear. Since the dogmatic figure of Christ is so sublime and spotless everything else turns dark besides it. It is, in fact, so one-sidedly perfect that it demands a psychic complement to restore the balance. So, as far as Jung is concerned, this image of God in Christianity being light, what's recognized officially, sets in motion a counter tendency to live out everything that has not been included in it. He's now going to pretty soon take this to history, but he just wants us to see that since human nature is a mixture of opposites, and since Christianity only symbolizes the light side of that opposite, that it's a natural law that to have the balance that really is what human nature is, the totality of human nature is, it forces a swing to the other side. So that the Christian image of God really introduces a stability into the very system that it defines. You might just want to think for a second, why is Jung so concerned about Christianity? Because we're going to take this to history in a second. He's not discussing this because he figures it's, you know, the better religion or anything like that. It's just that that's the religion that has defined Western civilization. So it's not, that's just a fact. It's not that Judaism is less important or Islam is less important, but the nature of our civilization has been shaped by Christian ideas, because it's a Christian civilization in its official definition. And the if you go to the top of the next page, after the paragraph 77, and what page you guys? Oh, the same page, 43. Mm-hmm. The coming of the Antichrist is not just a prophetic predilection, it is an inexorable psychological law. Same thing in different words. In other words, because Christianity defined God as light, it has forced Western civilization into a position of living out the dark at a certain point of history. And we'll talk about that.
Good, Gary. Can you tell a little bit more about the psychological need then, to have balance, you said, because it's all this way, then our need for balance makes it for that one?
Yeah, that nature will not allow a one-sided condition. Nature strives for balance. And because of the light being weighted on the one side, you might say a pendulum swing to one side, that sets up a dynamic of a pendulum swing to the other side of dark. Yeah?
I'm wondering if this split and this forcing of the acting out of the dark side has actually been the thing that has allowed Christianity to become so dominant, because it has allowed it to act out so much aggression against everything else. That if it had been a more balanced religion, would it have become as aggressive and dominant? So in other words, do these two things, is dominance play from the split?
Not in his view.
Okay.
We'll talk about how that works, though, because that's an important factor. I'm just slowly trying to acquaint you with his argument and really get... These are not the main points yet. These are just the foundational points. The main point comes up now in paragraph 78, which is what we've been leading to. I skipped the first sentence. A factor... See where I am?
Mm-hmm.
A factor that no one has reckoned with, however, is the fatality inherent in the Christian disposition itself, which leads inevitably to a reversal of its spirit, not through the obscure workings of chance, but accordance with psychological law. The ideal of spirituality, striving for the heights, was doomed to clash with the materialistic, earthbound passion to conquer matter and master the world. This change became visible at the time of the Renaissance. The word means rebirth, and it referred to the renewal of the antique spirit. We know today that this spirit was chiefly a mask. It was not the spirit of antiquity that was reborn, but the spirit of medieval Christianity that underwent strange pagan transformations. And here's the important sentence. Exchanging the heavenly goal for an earthly one, the vertical of the Gothic style for a horizontal perspective, voyages of discovery, exploration of the world and of nature. The subsequent developments that led to the Enlightenment and the French Revolution have produced a worldwide situation today which can only be called anti-Christian in a sense that confirms the early Christian anticipation of the end of time. That's the main thesis of the book right there. Let me try to paraphrase that. The situation at the birth of Christ was that Roman antiquity had become so decadent and so self-destructive in its pursuit of instinctual pleasure that there had to be a counter-swing away from that in order for civilization to survive. That's what Christianity did. It provided a spiritual counterpole of control and non-worldly values and non-instinctual values, non-libidinous values, non-egotistical values, and introduced a system of values of light, of kindness, of grace, of non-worldliness to pull people away from that tendency of the Roman era to destroy itself. That's the psychological function of Christianity as far as Jung is concerned, and that's the psychological effect and the psychological necessity of having a God image, a Christ image that is light. So a pendulum was swinging from instinctive brutality of the late antiquity to the spiritual grace of Christianity at the birth of Christ. That is symbolized, or that is represented, in the fact that Christ is all spirit, all light, all goodness. That was a necessary shift, as far as you're concerned. That's really the answer to Janice's question, is that humanity needed to stabilize itself. And that's why Christianity could have so much power. That set in a spiritualistic first eon, a spiritual first ion into Western history. So now Jung is taking the argument that we have been discussing, these two poles of the God image, or the two understandings of human nature, and he's applying them to history. The first eon of Western history, which lasted about 1,000 years, was a spiritual eon. The establishment of the monasteries, the propagation of Christianity, the non-worldly character of the Middle Ages, at least the early part of the Middle Ages, held sway for about 1,000 years. That itself was a pendulum swing and was one-sidedly limiting to the full nature of the human being. So to right that error, the pendulum had to start swinging the other way. And it swung toward, as he said here, a materialistic, worldly, power-oriented, secular, set of values and lifestyle. That would be the Renaissance, where the spirituality of the Middle Ages became the worldliness of the Medici Florence. Scientific Revolution, which put matter at the focus of our interests. The Age of Exploration and the imperialism of early, 18th, 19th centuries. That has made up the two poles of Western history up to now, a spiritual phase and material phase. A non-worldly phase and a worldly phase. A religious phase and a secular phase. A phase of grace, a phase of conquering. a phase of prayer, a phase of exploration. Spiritual, first 1,000 years, material, the next 1,000 years. And that Jung sees as inherent in the Christian personality of the split, which is characterized by a split between the light Christ and the devil. The light Christ, so to speak, lorded over the first 1,000 years until the pendulum had reached its apex. There had to be a turnaround to fulfill the requirements of human nature, and a materialistic phase then entered into this, the character of the second 1,000 years of Western civilization. That's his basic thesis. That's why the book's called Ion. Two major ions. Actually, four. Each one he divides up in two, but I think for our purposes, if you just get it, that there are two major periods. Why should we care? Because we are at the end of another pendulum swing. The first 1,000 years was a spiritual phase. Second 1,000 years was a material phase. We are beginning now a third 1,000-year period, which he sees as bringing with it the need now to synthesize these two extremes. Now it is time to mitigate the pendulum swings. That will be what the rest of the book deals with. So what's that mean? And as I said, I think Jungian psychology is based on a methodology that tries to pay attention to this unity between spirit and matter, that we don't single out the spirit, we don't single out the material world. So religious counseling, you might say, would single out the spirit as primary. Psychoanalytic, secular psychologies would single out the material, the instinct, the here and now as the primary focus. And Jung is saying either one of those are simply propagating the old split. And what he tried to do is find a way to work to begin on an individual basis to stop the pendulum swing. And perhaps if it starts on an individual basis, this will stop the massive swings societally.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just to add on, I was thinking about, you know, in terms of therapy, you know, the dialectical behavioral therapy is very much in vogue now, which has to do with aligning or the both the left and the right, the reasonable mind, the emotional mind, into what's called the wise mind, you know, the middle way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting, I think, that it's trying to...
That's, I didn't know that, yeah.
Do what you're saying here to join these two sides, you know.
That's really what Jung is trying to do. And so for the rest of the day, we're going to be looking at a little bit more on how he conceived of this pendulum swing. And then, what are we going to do about it? So that's our agenda for the rest of the day.
Suzanne, I saw the Dalai Lama yesterday.
Oh.
That was his emphasis, finding the middle way between the spiritual and the earthly.
Very nice.
That's through the cultivation of compassion. Mm-hmm. But that's the way to the middle way.
Yeah, Jung is going to have a different way, I'm afraid. not through compassion, but I think with compassion as the end point. But we'll see. Jung sees a different road there. Although I love the Dalai Lama.
You're interested, of course, in the Qing and all these things, the yin and yang.
Yeah.
I'm interested in other, you know, other ways of doing this that were done by other people. So your macrobiotic diet, for example, does the same thing. It balances the two sides in its dietary approach. And that's a Japanese approach. Mm. So there's been other cultures that have been aligned with this way.
Yeah, I think the essence of Buddhism is a synthesis of the opposites. Though there's a different model in Jung, I'm afraid. Yeah.
There was an interesting thing on Now last night, the program on CBS, about evangelical minister scientists having a group of important evangelical ministers going to Alaska to see the reality of global warming. And the one man who was the most skeptic said he finally realized that preaching could have an influence on people's behavior. So here's the, from the spiritual Bible people beginning to see that their spiritual, their preaching can influence people's behavior about the physical world. So it's interesting to see those things moving from both sides.
And I think certainly you can see that the earth now is kicking back, saying, this material thing has gone, is enough already. Right, exactly. Right. I also think, you know, Jung wrote this before we even knew of global warming. So it's really a psychological analysis, but I think it really does have very clear political consequences. We can get to that. Let's try to get the main argument first, and then if we have time, we can kind of see how that all applies to our politics today. Okay, now that's the first point. First and second point. We talked about Ion, we talked about how Christ is light, how the self is a duality, and how that has affected Western history. Now, Jung takes a little time to try to understand the way this split and synthesis that I've talked about has been symbolized in Western culture and how you are likely to see it in individuals' dreams. To that, he goes to astrology. So we're now at paragraph 128. I'll read it. It's not particularly self-evident, and then I'll try to explain it. In view of this wide distribution of the fish symbol, so we're talking about the fish symbol now. its appearance at a particular place or at a particular moment in the history of the world is no cause for wonder. But the sudden activation of the fish symbol and its identification with Christ, even in the early days of the church, lead one to conjecture a second source. This source is astrology. Let me try to explain that. To do that, I need to introduce my top. Like if I go maybe in the center, you can see it.
Put my deodorant holes. Hey, you'll get it if it doesn't.
I don't have much resistance.
Oh, good. I picked the right dress. Now, see if I can get this thing spinning right. Well, I did it before. There. Okay. Now watch what happens as it loses speed. It's already doing it a little bit. And it starts to wobble. If I could have gotten this, yeah, there it goes. That's a big wobble. In astrological terms, that wobble, what we say in ordinary speech, is a precession of the axis. It's not procession, it's precession.
So I demonstrate that to show you what a precession of an axis is, because that has everything to do with the astrological symbolism that we'll be looking at. Because the Earth's axis is precessing. If you remember the astrological pictures you probably saw in high school or astronomy, that's not astrological, astronomical. The Earth is at a tilt, and that tilt is slowly wobbling. So slow that it takes 26,000 years for one precession of the axis. Everybody with me on that?
Mm-hmm.
That's really key. There's a slight tilt. That's
precession means
precession means wobble.
Oh.
And it wobbles because the rotation is slowly decelerating, but so slow that it takes 26,000 years for one rotation. Yeah.
So is this what's supposed to happen at 2012?
We're going to be getting to the astrological ages.
But at 2012, that tilt was supposed to come back to. That's some of the things they've talked about in some of the websites about 2012, that it is that, I can't remember exactly, but coming back to the same point again. I'll try and find.
Yeah, no, because it's a 26, I mean, it's coming back to where it was 26,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, but.
I'll find whatever.
I'm not sure we're talking about the same thing or not. I don't know. But what this then leads into, is a discussion of the precession of the equinoxes. So if you got the basic idea that what a precession is, it's a wobble, that the Earth is very, 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 very slowly wobbling. Its axis is wobbling. The Earth rotates on an axis. The Earth is spinning. And then that axis itself is wobbling. So there's two movements of the Earth. It's rotation and it's wobble. But it's a 26,000 year wobble. Now, we're going to look very basically at astrological symbolism, and then I'll try to explain why he's so interested in this. This is a view of the universe. There's at least the Earth and the Sun, and then the constellations around the universe that make up the astrological signs. Here's the constellation Aries, Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and so on. That these are in the stars out beyond the solar system. Now what we need to understand now is what the spring point is. The spring point is when, on the first day of spring, when the sun rises, in what constellation that sun is seen. So right now, when the sun rises, on the first day of spring, we on the Earth are seeing the sun basically right about here. For the last 2,000 years, the sun has been seen in this constellation. Now it's being seen in this constellation. Why? Because when the Earth wobbles, when it's at a certain point on its axis of rotation, that point where the Earth is on its orbit for a given season varies. So let's take it to the extreme. Let's suppose this is summer. And so every time the Earth comes back here, it's summer. But I'm doing it in the extreme, in 13,000 years, it's going to be winter when it's over here, because the Earth has wobbled one half of the rotation. So when it's summer, it's going to be over here. So when the sun rises in the summer now, look, if the Earth were on this point, the sun would be in a particular, would be seen against the backdrop of a particular constellation. But 13,000 years from now, in that same season, when the sun is again, Earth is again leading toward the sun, that when that sun rises, it's going to be seen against a different constellation. That's the two extremes, summer and winter. But spring is when it's not leading, but when it's more or less even with respect, when the Earth is more like that. And as far as the sun is concerned, it's got an equal radiation on the Earth. So the idea Jung now works with is the spring point, or the point which defines what age we are living in, because each of these periods will be about 2,000 years. That's called one Platonic month, or one age. So the song, The Age of Aquarius, means that right now, when the sun rises, if you were up on the first day of spring and you could see the sun against the constellation in the background, you would see the sun against the juncture of Aquarius and Pisces. Does that make sense to everybody? What interests Jung now is where the sun has been in the last 2,000 years. Because that's a sign that has been symbolized by the fish. Pisces is a double fish. It's a fish that has a vertical orientation, and it's a fish that has a horizontal orientation. You go back, see Pisces, these are the stars, that would be the vertical fish, and that would be the horizontal fish. And the astrological understanding of that is that it is two fishes.
So, they say the age of Aquarius, and then they don't say the age of Aquarius and Taurus, right? They're together, aren't they, and the next mm-hmm. one?
The next age will be Capricorn.
Oh, we're going that way around.
Going that way.
Okay.
So we're in this 2,000-year period. We've just left this 2,000-year period.
Okay, the band at the bottom is way ahead of us then. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So
in that next picture, they look like they were lined in the same band, you know.
It shouldn't be.
Well, I just didn't know how it was configured.
Yeah. See, Aquarius, Capricorn, yeah. Sagittarius, Scorpio.
I just didn't know if they were lined with the ones below them.
Oh yeah, no, This is the background of the heavens, and this would be the constellation against which the sun would be seen, due to the precession of the Earth's axis. It's at a different, slightly different point each year when spring comes, and that means we see it the sun against a slightly different background. But what Jung is going to work with now is this coincidence that fish symbolism played such a big role in Christianity, and Christianity was born just at the beginning of Pisces. He's not trying to draw any kind of magical conclusion, just say, isn't that interesting that the presence of fish symbolism in Christianity coincided with the presence of fish symbolism in the age of Pisces? Yeah.
Haven't Jung just been talking on our Saturday thing about the fact that that fish symbolism was also with other religions at the same time?
Yes, I'm just trying to give it Jung 101 here. But he does go into a great discussion of fish symbolism in the book. I'm just trying to give you the very simple argument. If you get the simple argument, hopefully, you then can go to the book and begin to study it yourself, knowing the basics. I think I don't know if I mentioned it or not. Edinger has a commentary on each of these major books. The commentary for this book is called the Ion Lectures. And hopefully, if you've got the basic idea from this day, it will give you enough to go to the Ion Lectures to understand it. If you can understand the Ion Lectures, you can go to the book itself. What's so confusing about Jung is like take the fish. He'll take the fish image, and I'm just trying to give you the main argument. He'll go off into 10 other cultures, and producing you're going, my God, why are we over here in Phoenicia? I thought he was talking about Christianity, and you so easily get lost. But if you can always come back to your basic understanding, I think it's not too difficult to read. And that's what I'm trying to do, is just give you the absolute basics. Yeah.
Another point I think that would be important is, from astrology's point of view, is that astrology looks out from the earth into the heavens, and so it's a way of dealing with the individual in relationship to the self, because it's like the heavens are the self, the great possibility, and we're looking out from the earth, us. So if astrology itself is doing something very similar that Jung is doing, trying to deal with the individual versus the larger possibility of God or all that is. So that's why I think the symbolism this back and forth because they're working from the same point of view.
Right. Now, compare the fish symbolism with what I just described about the two periods of history. There was a vertical period of history and a horizontal period of history, a spiritual period of history and a material period of history. So that Jung is seeing the coincidence in the symbolism here between the nature of the first 1,000 years of history being symbolized by the vertical fish, and the second 1,000 years of history being symbolized by the horizontal fish. So that just like we discussed from the standpoint of the effect of the Christ image on history, Jung now is drawing a parallel between those two periods and the two periods that are implied also in the two fish of the constellation of Pisces. Again, the first 1,000-year period is a spiritual one, monasteries, and the flowering of religious cults. The second period being exploration, Renaissance, Reformation, science, all the revolutions establishing a secular government up until today, which is at the end of that period of history, where the swing from vertical to horizontal has taken place. Now the task is, as I said, to unite those two fish in a single attitude.
There just might be a point just to mention Al Powell's work, if anybody wants more amplification on that astrological piece that you just went because she's the one that picked up the new left off in astrology, Alice O'Howell, at Edinger, and he's the one that said to her, that's your work. So she's got lots of books on this.
Does she talk about this specifically?
Yeah,
does
the whole book on the whole book on the ages.
Right.
Does she?
Astrology. Right.
What's it?
It's Alice H-O-W-E-L-L. It's called Jung, it's called Astrology and Jungian Symbolism.
Is there one in particular you'd recommend?
Astrological Ages.
Yeah, that's the most escalated.
Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
What's the title?
There's more to that title.
Yeah, if you go online and look. She has one on geometry, sacred geometry, called The Red and the Sea. And then she has Union and Astrology and Union Symbolism. And then her most recent one. Oh, The Heavens Declare.
Yeah.
It's called The Heavens Declare.
Astrological Ages.
Something like that, yeah. With the first time
she goes clear back to Taurus.
Well, she starts way back to the first beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, you could. Certainly.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's an astrologer primarily, but
she's a Jungian
astrologer.
Well, she's an analyst too.
Oh, she's not actually an analyst.
No. She worked with an analyst in the East.
Didn't she work with you?
She just very quickly. Her story is she started studying astrology when she was 20, but she didn't discover Jung until in her 40s.
Oh.
And then she decided she was going to go become an analyst, but she was in analysis with Edinger at the time. And he said to her, you, my dear, are not to do analysis. You're to pick up where Jung left off in astrology. Because she'd been doing astrology. You know, we didn't have computers back then, so she knew it.
By hand, huh? Yeah.
So she didn't write her first book until she was 70.
Wow.
And she's an astrologer, so she only uses astrology to help people create frameworks for their life.
I see.
And what she's wanting to do is to have more analysts pick up on chart reading.
I see.
To help to use that.
Yeah.
But she herself...
I thought she was okay. I didn't know that. Thank you.
Excuse me. And who is the woman that was sponsored by Last Spring at PTS?
Because the book, the book that she's talking about is dedicated to Sylvia.
She writes letters.
That's the letter thing. So there's a real close connection. That's the Jungian analyst connection.
Mm-hmm.
Great, thank you.
Yes, she has. Just quickly, she, I read her life story, so we talked about it for several hours, but she's a fascinating woman. Mm-hmm. But that's how she...
Didn't she work with Sheila Moon at some point? Wasn't she part of the Guilt of Psychological Studies in San Francisco?
No. Well,
I
shouldn't say no. I'm not sure.
I thought she was. Alice Allen Schubert. See, that's not the case.
Well, I will check with her. I know about her work in Chicago and Santa Barbara, but we're at, like, she's 45 is where we are in his life story right now, so I'm not real clear.
Yeah.
And what's the publishing house is in Chicago, that's where the Alice Bailey work and everything, the Theosophical Society is her publishing house.
Quest
in Chicago.
They published that book by Dave Lindorf, too, on Pali.
So you can get the book feedback.
Okay, one paragraph, 142. So, train of thought. Christ image effects on history. Interesting parallel in astrology. Two fish. Now, 142. He starts to try to tie this all together. As seems probable, the eon of the fishes, that's why we had to go through all this stuff. The eon of the fishes is ruled by the archetypal motif of the hostile brothers, meaning the two fish. Then the approach of the next Platonic month, namely Aquarius, will constellate the problem of the union of opposites. That's what all of this was to get to show us the psychological task of the time is to begin to unite these two opposites of spirit and matter that have been lived out sequentially. Now they are to be lived out as a challenge to synthesis. It will then no longer be possible to write off evil as the mere privation of good. Its real experience will have to be recognized. This problem can be solved neither by philosophy, nor by economics, nor by politics, but only by the individual human being via his experience of the living spirit. That's the what for. The task now is to unite spirit and matter. Where up to now it's been lived out first spirit, then matter. What that means, of course, will occupy the rest of the book. He's hopefully you can see how he's slowly doing historical analysis to help us understand why he has developed his understanding of human transformation the way he has. It's really based on a historical understanding, and what we've just said is it. Okay, I'll sum up what he's said now. He'll sum up what he said on paragraph 148. Hopefully, when you hear what he says, it'll be what we just said. So if it doesn't, holler. Although no connection of any kind can be proved between the figure of Christ and the inception of the astrological age of the fishes, the simultaneity, that's the big word, the simultaneity of fish symbolism, of the fish symbolism, of the Redeemer with the astrological symbol of the new eon seems to me important enough to warrant the emphasis we place upon it. If we try to follow up the complicated mythological ramifications of this parallel, we do so with the intent to throw light on the multifarious aspects of an archetype that manifests itself, on the one hand in a personality, and on the other hand synchronistically in a moment of time determined in advance before Christ's birth. So that what we're going to see, this theme of uniting the opposites, and indeed fish symbols representing the unity of opposites, is going to be going on in the individual the same way it's going on thematically in the astrological conception of things, and the same way it's going on theoretically in his conception of history. And of course this occurs in people who have no knowledge whatsoever of Jungian psychology. It's just a coincidence. He thought, wow, what is going on? You see it in people, you see it in astrology, And you see it when you understand the psychological implications of what we know about human nature when looking at the portrayal of the Christ image. Indeed, that's probably enough there. I skip a little bit. It becomes a matter, same paragraph 148. It becomes a matter for astonishment. Only when, through the precession of the equinoxes, the spring point moves into this sign and thus inaugurates an age in which the fish was used as a name for God who became man, who was born as a fish and sacrificed as a ram. Who had fishermen for disciples and wanted to make them fishers of men, who fed the multitude with miraculously multiplying fishes, who was himself eaten as a fish, the holier food, and whose followers are little fishes, the Pisculia, I guess that's right. And I go over to 149. Okay, so far? The northerly or easterly fish, that's the vertical fish, which the spring point entered at about the beginning of our era, is joined to the southerly or westerly fish, the horizontal fish, by the so-called commissure, and that's it. Did I say it right?
Commissure.
Commissure. That's that. Vertical fish, horizontal fish. Commissure. This consists of a band of faint stars forming the middle sector of the constellation, and the spring point gradually moved along its meridian at the tail of the second fish. The spring point where the elliptic intersects with the meridian at the tail of the second fish coincides roughly with the 16th century, the time of the Reformation, which, as we know, is so extraordinarily important for the history of Western symbols. Since then, the spring point has moved along the southern edge of the second fish and will enter Aquarius in the course of the third millennium, which is us now. Astrologically interpreted, the designation of Christ as one of the fishes identifies him with the first fish, the vertical one. Christ is followed by the Antichrist at the end of time, the beginning of the two, the beginning of the Enantiodromia. Enantiodromia means swinging into its opposite. The beginning of the swinging into its opposite would fall logically midway between the two fishes. We've seen that this is so. The time of the Renaissance begins in the immediate vicinity of the second fish, and with it comes that spirit which culminates in the modern age. So the vertical fish would be the spiritual phase of Christianity. The horizontal fish would be the material phase of Western civilization. It's called Christianity, but it's so secular in effect that it's hardly recognizable as the early understanding of Christianity. And now we're at the end of that, faced with bringing the two together, so that the task becomes uniting spirit and matter, uniting the vertical and the horizontal in one conscious attitude. Well, that's point three. We will build on that from here, because what he'll do now is say, okay, so what's that mean practically? How do you unite spirit and matter? But let's make sure you're okay with the basic argument so far. I'll take that to mean you are. Okay, let's go on now to what he's going to do now is examine psychologically what is the nature of that second fish. Because what he's going to find is that the way we unite spirit and matter is to start with that second fish, because that is defining our time, and plucking the spirit out of it. But where religion will start with the spirit, Jung starts with matter. That second fish is our starting point. What's the nature of the second fish? How do we understand it? How do you get spirit out of matter? And what's that mean for therapy? So it becomes pretty practical pretty soon. But he's gone from history now to the fish symbolism. And as you know, in our work, we work with images. So we can't work with concepts. So he goes to the fish image now, and he'll spend the rest of the book on that fish image and what that means for us. Let's see, is there anything else I wanted to say? No, I think we can go ahead to page one, paragraph 169. One thing I didn't mention, which I probably should have mentioned, the first, you know, we started at paragraph 70-something. The first part of the book up to that is just a review of all his basic concepts. That's why I didn't spend any time on. He goes through the shadow, the animus, the self. I'm assuming you know all that stuff, because this is not Jung intro. It's more trying to get you acquainted with the more advanced works. Now, he goes to Judaism. Paragraph 169. In the Judaic... not in official Talmudic Judaism, but in the traditions that have sprung up around it, it is said that that the Messiah consists of two parts. So he's looking for other places that this idea of Christ or the Messiah being two has existed, and he finds it in Judaism. And the split between the two messiahs in this tradition is said to be healed at the coming of the new Messiah. So within Judaism, the coming of the Messiah is depicted as a healing of the split within the Messiah. Whenever he has that idea, he goes to another tradition to see, has anyone else had this thought, or am I just crazy? And he found in Judaism this same idea, that the end of time, the healing of the split, will be accomplished at the second coming.
And what is the split there? Is it the same split?
It's not exactly the same. We'll talk about that. Okay. But I think you could say a worldly and a non-worldly. But he was just interested that somebody else beside him saw that the Savior image was split and saw that it was a goal religiously, of course he's looking at it psychologically, for the healing of the split. If you're not confused so far, let me throw something out that just doesn't quite fit here. I'm really trying to build an argument, but it's such an interesting little point he makes. And we'll look at it. We'll look at some dreams, by the way, but at the end of the day, that illustrate all these points. But there's a very, very powerful sentence on paragraph 170, the italics, about two-thirds of the way down the page. And I've got a dream that shows this so clearly. That's why I'm mentioning it. Otherwise, I would skip over it. The destruction of the God image is followed by the annulment of the human personality. Just remember that. See where I am?
Annulment.
Destruction of the God image is followed by the annulment of the human personality. You might ask yourself, why does he make such a fuss about the God image? Because he feels that is the foundation of the ego. When that is missing in a society, the ego can't form. That's in a parenthesis, but we'll come back to that. I just wanted to mention, it's not really part of the main discussion, but as long as you're with me, I thought it'd be worth mentioning.
When God image is missing, the ego can't form.
Yeah. Well, we can afford a detail, right? The dream I'll mention... is from a book called The Third Reich of Dreams. And it's a German woman at the rise of Hitler, for some reason, went around collecting her neighbor's dreams and published them. I met the woman's great niece about a couple of years ago, and that's how I learned about it. The book's called The Third Reich of Dreams. And make sure I get it right. The dream of one of her neighbors, I want to read it to you directly, was this. In place of the street signs, which had been abolished, posters had been set up on every corner, proclaiming in white letters on a black background the 20 words that we were not allowed to say by the Third Reich. That makes sense. A poster was put up. This didn't exist in reality. A poster was put up with the 20 words you were not allowed to say. The first was Lord. The second was I. See, that's why Jung spends so much time on that. Fascism is the destruction of the ego, and it's also a destruction of the foundation of the ego, which is the God image. Anyway, just that's on the wall aside. Paragraph 174. What he's going to do now is look mythologically, that's kind of what you were referring to, look mythologically at the way fish has been described in tradition. Certainly at the time of Christ, this is relevant. And now I'm at 174, paragraph 174, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines down. Concupiscentia. Concupiscentia means like unbridled desire. It's a medieval Latin concept. Party animal might be, not a bad synonym. Concupiscentia is attributed to fishes, which are said to be ambitious, libidinous, voracious, avarice, lascivious. In short, an emblem of the vanity of the world and of earthly pleasures. So on the one hand, the fish is an image of greed and lust. As he says, probably because the fish was associated with the mother goddess. And then that's the way the mother goddess was interpreted in a patriarchal framework. Somebody's recorder just went off.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm fine. I can understand the book. I'm just listening. Hello. I'm making notes. I'll go back and read.
Page 112, continuing on that same paragraph. Christ, second line, Christ is not only a fisher, but the fish that is eucharistically eaten. Augustine says in his Confessions, but the earth eats the fish that was drawn from the deep at the table which you have prepared for them that believe. For the fish was drawn from the deep in order to nourish the needy ones of the earth. So two senses of the fish show up mythologically. One, it's greed, and the other, that it's spirit. This is an anticipation of where we're going. Where we're going is, if we think that the two messiahs, the two fish, two sides of the God image, must now be synthesized. And one side is greed, and the other side is to be eaten spiritually. The synthesis of the two will be to find the spirit within the greed.
So one is greed and the other was
Christ.
The desire to be eaten, you said?
Well, that is what is done with the fish, and that would be the desire to imbibe the spirit,
okay,
to take in the spirit. But when the two fish are united, both are eaten, you see. And that means that the eating of the fish to integrate the spirit, to take in the spirit, is the same thing as eating the greed to take in the spirit. Because they are united when the polarity ceases to be in charge.
So if you eat the fish, you're imbibing of both aspects.
Well, where he's going to go with that is that the psychological task of the time is to get the spirit of Christ, or the spirit, period, through eating or approaching what has traditionally been called greed, lascivious, and bad.
So you're not talking about uniting the opposites?
That is uniting the opposites.
Okay, you are talking about uniting the opposites.
Uniting the opposites is finding the, you might say, finding the spiritual fish within the material fish.
So one can't turn their back on the greed aspect of the self. One has to turn towards it and embrace it.
Turn towards the greed aspects of the self and find in it the spirit that was lived out once separately, now that's looking to be lived out with and alongside the greed. And when I say greed, desire, all the qualities that are mentioned. Ambition, libidinous desires, voraciousness, avarice, lasciviousness. The whole physiological, desirous side of life, including the workings of your body. Yeah.
Isn't greed a hunger? But it's an unconscious hunger. So aren't you talking about becoming conscious of what you're hungry for beneath the subtle? But isn't greed very often a substitute for...
That would be getting the spirit out of...
Yeah. In other words, being conscious of, so that the ego is aware of what it real, where its nourishment comes from. Because greed is an attempt to get nourished, but very often in the, you know, you eat too much of the wrong stuff and you don't get nourished, so it's an endless cycle. So it's the whole idea of eating and the fish being something that feeds you is very much part of what greed is all about.
Kind of, but there's more to it. We need to go back to our definition of spirit. I know some of you heard this so many times that I hesitate to say it again, but I'm going to have to. You know your definition of spirit? The factor? factor that engenders images in the inner field of vision, in other words, creates dreams, creates fantasies, and organizes them, that's the key word here, them into a meaningful order. So that when you've understood one dream, the next dream is a step ahead of the previous dream. That is so because there is something in us doing that, and Jung gives that the word spirit. Now to go back to our earlier discussion, see, what Christianity did was organize behavior away from greed and lust and gluttony. And Jung is not trying to say that is God or not, that is not God. He just says that is a valid psychological dynamism that we are born with, as opposed to the psychoanalytic point of view that thinks we are just instinct. Jung says, no, we are not just desire. We also come in to the world with this capacity to transform ourselves. The nature of spirit is that it lifts you above nature, above the body, above desire, left on its own. And that's what was working. That's how, psychologically speaking, how Christianity got us away from the Roman catastrophe. Because it gave us the impulses to move toward kindness and generosity and non-worldliness. That is an intrinsic drive, as far as Jung is concerned. But you see, it's non-material. It's intelligent. It leads, but it's non-material. That's why it was a valid response and also a limited response, because it excluded the material side of life, instinctual and worldly and material side of life. So the first fish, you could say, is a sort of guide. The second fish is desire. And the synthesis of those two fish now is going back to the desire, hunger, as Janus said, for example, and finding how embedded within that desire is a capacity for guidance. There is an intelligence within the heart of this chaotic emotion, desire, avarice, egotism, and so on. Probably time to take a break.